We said there were three big sections in the Old Testament. What were the three big sections?
History,
poetry, prophecy. And the New Testament similarly has three sections, although they aren't the same three as the Old Testament. Is it a freak of chance that the Bible is laid out in that way in the Old Testament? What purpose is there in that? Who put the books of the Bible in the order that they're in? The church did. It's not inspired, it's just helpful. The New Testament has similarly have three sections. Turn to your table of contents, please. In your table of contents, tell me the first five books. I'll give you help. In the New Testament, we got Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. Okay, before we go into Romans, what was it those first five books all have in common? They are history. So just like the first section of the Old Testament is history, the first section of the New Testament is also history. That's got five books in it. The second section has got 13 books in it. How many books does the second section have? 13. You still got your table of contents out. The second section of the Old Testament was poetry. We don't have that in the New Testament. Starting with Romans, what kind of books are those? What are those called after Romans? What?
Epistles.
What is an epistle? If it's not the wife of an apostle. Yeah, so if you're a theologian and you want to sound big and important, you don't say letter, you say epistle. So they're letters. That's all they are. The second section is in two parts, A and B. Two parts. We're going to talk about those two parts. 2A goes from Romans through 2 Thessalonians. You got your table of contents out. So you'll see Romans, and then it's followed by what? 1st, 2nd Corinthians, and followed by Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. Stop right there. There are nine letters in 2A. And when you look at these names that y'all just said out loud, those are names of people, places, or things?
Places.
Most of them are cities, except one is not a city. Galatia. It's not a city. What is it? It's just like Georgia. It's a region. It's an area. 2A, these nine books, have two things in common. One is the author. Who wrote all of them?
Paul.
The second they have in common is that they are letters to places and not people. They're specific churches. 2B is also written by Paul, and that's your next books, which is? What's after Thessalonians? 1st and 2nd Timothy. Titus, and Philemon, based on their names, what do those four books have in common? Okay, did these people write these books or did they read these books? Obviously, if Paul wrote it, they just read it. So those are Paul's letters, not to churches, but to people. So there are three people and four books in the second section of the second part. Someone else has noticed that these books, I don't know if this is purposeful or accidental, but they're all arranged also by the order of their length, from the longest to the shortest. Interesting. Now, the third section of the New Testament has nine books in it. So this one, so I got 5, 13, we got 9. And the third section starts with Hebrews and goes to the end. So let's just read through that list. We got Hebrews, then James, then 1st and 2nd Peter, then 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, then Jude, then Revelation. Notice the last book of the New Testament, is it a singular book or is it a plural book?
Singular.
It is not the book of Revelations. It's the book of Revelation. And let me all say, you're not all Baptists, you're Baptist. Now this third section is a little bit harder to figure out because Hebrews is an ethnic group, not a place. James, Peter, John, Jude are different people. Was the book of James written to James or by James? How about the book of Jude? This is not to whom it's written. This is actually who wrote it. But what do these books have in common? It's stuff Paul didn't write. There you go. So part two is what Paul wrote. Part three is stuff Paul didn't write. And also what they have in common is they call them general epistles. Why are they called general epistles? Yeah, typically they're not a specific church being written to, and typically not a particular person. For instance, James, who does he address his letter to?
12 tribes scattered abroad.
The 12 tribes scattered abroad. General epistles. So they're kind of general. So first, they're not written by Paul. Second, they're general. Third thing they have in common is, generally speaking, they're Jewish in nature, like Hebrews. Paul's letters tend to be to Gentile churches because he was the apostle to the Gentiles. These other letters in this third section tend to be to Jewish Christians, tend to be. So that's some of those differences. Now, we said the Old Testament has how many books in it? What way did I give you to remember that? Okay, the old got three letters. The word testament has nine letters. There are 39 books in the Old Testament. Now, how many books are in the New Testament? There's 27. Now, the crazy way you remember that is you take three and multiply it times nine, and you come up with the 27 books of the New Testament. The other silly thing I told you, there was a guy named J.B. Phillips who did the Phillips translation. He only did the 27 books of the New Testament. If he had taken a notion to translate the 39 books of the Old Testament, he could have taken the 39 books of the Old Testament, put them together with 27 books of the New Testament, and had a new translation and called it Phillips 66. So there are 66 books in the whole Bible. Now, that won't make you holy to know that. It won't make you spiritual to know that. But I want you to be able to kind of drive around in the thing and just kind of know the big picture of it. Actually, yes, they do. They really do. So when you look at your table of contents, now you see that's the logic behind the arrangement of the books. It's not an accident. The early church did that for you. Now, it's also not inspired. The Jewish Bible is not in the same order that our Bible is. Did you know that? And it's okay if somebody wants to change around our Bible. There's nothing inspired in that. Now, at this point, you should get your handout. And so I want to go over that handout. Remember how we drew a timeline of Old Testament history and put all the old books of the Old Testament into it? Now we're going to do that with the New Testament. Across the very top, you'll see a box, that rectangular box numbered 13 through 28. What is that box? Okay, that is the book of Acts. Aside from the history book, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which occur before Acts, all the rest of the history books of the New Testament fit back into Acts, starting with chapter 13. So that's why I didn't put that other stuff on there. It just takes that room. A lot of this can be built around the life of Paul. So there's book of Acts, 13 through 28. Right below that, you see 1st, 2nd, and 3rd mission. What's that about? Paul went on three missionary journeys. And those chapters above each of those three tell you about it in the book of Acts. So, for instance, if you read about first missionary journey, it's in chapters what? 13 and 14. And based on this, how many times was Paul in jail?
Twice.
So you can read about that, for instance, in chapter 22 through 28. The second time he's in jail is not covered in the book of Acts. But it's from other writings that we know that he was. So let's drop down and take this apart. The first missionary journey happened over what years? 48 to 49. While he was on the first missionary journey, you notice below that is, I've got a set of brackets. The top brackets are Paul's letters. The bottom brackets are these general epistles, the non-Paul letters. So let's go back to Paul's letters. While he was on the first missionary journey, Paul wrote the first of his letters. He was in Antioch when he wrote it, and the year was 49. Who knows what letter that was? The oldest book that Paul wrote.
Galatians.
Galatians is one of the oldest books in the New Testament. The Gospels were all written after this. Even though they're the oldest material, they're the newest books as far as when they were written. About the time Paul was writing Galatians, over in Jerusalem, somebody else was busy writing a letter. Who knows the other oldest book in the New Testament? It's James. So right below in that box, in your third row, write James. Now, whereas Paul was in Antioch in his first missionary journey when he wrote Galatians, James evidently was in Jerusalem. So you can put a question mark there. And the years around 49-50. Interesting how those two books kind of offset each other and they balance each other out. Now, if you go back up to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 15 is about something that's very important, and you drop all the way down to that circle right here under chapter 15. That's the Jerusalem Council. What did they decide in the Jerusalem Council? I think we looked at that last week. The Gentiles don't have to follow the law of Moses. I got a phone call from a guy that's visited our church one time. He stayed here one summer. This guy has been going to a messianic congregation for the last 10 years, and he's all hung up on Torah-compliant Christianity. In fact, he thinks God wants all Gentile Christians to be under the law of Moses. I talked to him for about an hour. A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Doesn't matter what I said, we have to be under the law of Moses. Anyway, the Jerusalem Council made the point that, no, you're not under the law of Moses. He says, oh, that's only to be saved. Only to be saved, but you're only made holy through keeping the law of Moses. But that was in the autumn of AD 49. AD 49 was Jerusalem Council. So I just drew a circle right here where you can fit it in. Then in Acts chapter 16, Paul goes on his second missionary journey. I think your years are in there, from 50 to 52 AD. While he was on the second missionary journey, the first book he wrote here is 1 Thessalonians. So right below 2 Missions, write 1 Thessalonians. Who knows where he was when he wrote it? No, sir. That's to whom he wrote it. He wouldn't write it to him if he was there to see him in person. He was in Corinth when he wrote this. The year is AD 51. Right below 1 Thessalonians, right? 2 Thessalonians. He was still in Corinth when he wrote that. And the year is still AD 51. Now, these are guesses. Some of them are technically precise. Some of them are just intelligent guesses. Now we go to the third missionary journey, Acts chapter 19 through 21. Notice it occurred from about AD 53 to 57. It's a longer trip. And while on the third missionary journey, the first box below that, right in 1 Corinthians. Who knows where Paul was when he wrote 1 Corinthians? Ephesus. It's thought he was in Ephesus. Year? AD 56. Right below 1 Corinthians? Right? 2 Corinthians. This time he's in Macedonia when he writes that. And the year is still 56. Right below that, in the third box, is the book that all theologians, if they could only pick one book of the New Testament to be stranded with on a desert island, this is one they always pick. Romans. Guess where he was when he wrote it? Well, they think he was in Corinth, because he sends greetings from the people in Corinth. So he's in Corinth, the year is 56, 57, somewhere in there. Now, you got a gap between the third mission and the first jail. Even though the books, it still goes from Acts chapter 21 to 22. I put a gap there so you could draw another circle and put Paul on trial. The record of Paul's trials. And that's AD 57 to 59. Then we bump over here to his first time in jail.
What years was that again?
He's on trial 57 to 59. Oh, I just drew another circle. It's in that gap between the third mission and the first jail. The story of the trials is protracted. First time he's in jail. Remember, Martin Luther was in jail in Birmingham. He wrote that letter from a Birmingham jail. Well, Paul wrote some letters from jail, too. Martin Luther King. Yeah. Now, I got to keep these Martin Luthers. They all get run together in my mind. First book he wrote in jail was Ephesians. We're going to put him in Rome. Some people don't think he was in Rome, but that's all right. We're going to make him in Rome. And the year is AD 60. After he got done with Ephesians, we'll put him down here for Colossians. Also from Rome. We'll make that 61. Right underneath that, put Philemon from Rome. We'll put that in 61. And right under that, we'll put Philippians from Rome, AD 62. So these are the epistles Paul composed in prison. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. Rome. Paul was roaming around. No, he wasn't roaming around. That's the problem. He's in prison. Rome, 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 Rome. 60, 61, 61, 62. Epistles Paul composed in prison. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Philemon. Now we're going to leave the book of Acts and go out into unknown territory. We run out of history in Acts. But between his first time in jail and his second time in jail, Paul wrote two letters to apostolic workers. The first one is 1 Timothy. He was in Macedonia when he wrote it, and the year will make it 62. Underneath that is Titus. That's when he wrote his letter to Titus. He's in Asia Minor, and that's AD 66. All these places Paul went have names different today than they did then. He went to Turkey is where he went. He went to central Turkey, then western Turkey, then he went over to Greece and Bulgaria. and they made it to Italy. That's where Paul went. While Paul was free and was writing to Timothy and Titus, drop down below that. Now we go to the general epistles. Peter got in on the act. Peter wrote 1 Peter, and below that, 2 Peter. We think he was in Rome when he wrote it, which is where it's tradition that he was killed. That's why the Catholics always talk about Peter being the bishop of Rome. Well, the history is that he wound up in Rome and was killed there.
I thought I heard that challenged. Uh-huh. I thought there was no evidence that Peter ever went
to Rome. Well, it's tradition. So you can say that. I'll take that. Sure. Put a question mark there after Rome. The year is 64. 64.
You wrote both of them in 64?
Yes, what we think. Then Paul got chunked on the Huskow again, so we put second jail over here. 67, 68 is about when it was. While he's in jail the second time, he wrote 2 Timothy. We think he's in Rome. You can put a question mark there. AD 67. And, of course, tradition has he was killed there. While he's in jail, right straight below that, in the general epistles, the book of Hebrews was written by an unknown author. Some people say it was Apollos. Some people say it was Paul. Nobody knows. Year 67. Also, that's when Jude was written. Of course, the Beatles picked up on that, one of their songs. And, Hey Jude, it was written. We don't know where he was when he wrote it, but it was 67 to 68. And then finally, after Paul is in jail, last books of the New Testament written out here, we got under general epistles, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Revelation, singular. Now those dates are debated, but John seems to have been in Ephesus when he died late in life, so we're going to put 1 John, 2 John, 3 John from Ephesus is where he wrote it. There's a fella that's been at our church before, wrote a book called An Evening with John in Ephesus. And the idea was John's this very aged disciple of Jesus, the last one still alive. He's living in Ephesus, and this young guy goes and interviews him about his vision of the revelation. And so it's really a commentary on the book of Revelation. Anyway, that's where we think John was, is Ephesus. When was it written? Well, you're going to get all over the board, anywhere between 66 and 99. I think in the 60s, some people think in the 90s. That's debatable. Now, the same with the book of Revelation. Anywhere between before the fall of Jerusalem in the 60s all the way up through the 90s. Anyway, these were still the last books written. So that's how the New Testament books fit chronologically relative to Acts.
So Pat Moses is in Ephesus.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said the wrong... I didn't. Thank you. No, he wrote Revelation for Patmos.
But where is it?
What's it near?
Yeah,
it's an island off the coast of Turkey.
That was a criminal colony, or where they put the criminals?
Yes, Patmos was like a criminal colony. It's like Australia, a big island they stuck criminals on. What were you asking, Keisha?
First box.
The very first box is the first book, probably of the New Testament written, which was Galatians. All right. In the time remaining, the great problem the churches wrestle with from the earliest days is the relationship between the church and Israel. Israel. All you politicians immediately said, state.
I thought he said Satan.
Oh, did you say Satan? That's bad too. Henry Chadwick wrote a book called The Early Church, and here's what he said. The central questions of the apostolic age turned on the continuity or the discontinuity of the church with Israel. Of course, we're still talking about it today. Here's the question as we study the relationship between the New Testament and the Old Testament. Is it the church and Israel? Or is it the church is Israel? Now, this question was hot in the first century. It was answered for the next, basically, 2,000 years, and now it's become hot again since World War II. What goes around comes around. That's the issue. Which of these options is what the Bible teaches? Neither one is heresy, it's just somebody's mistaken. Historically, there's only, that I've seen, three ways to answer this question. Now, you believe one of these three things I'm about to say, if you believe anything. But you're going to meet a lot of people, they're going to believe one of these three things. You're going to read a book, you're going to hear a sermon, you're going to watch a TV show. And the guy who's teaching, if he's teaching on this subject, is going to believe one of these three things. And if you understand these three things, you'll have a better feel for where he's coming from. So I'm not going to teach right or wrong. I'm just going to tell you. Now, I'll tell you which one I think, but I'm not going to try to disprove anybody. You see what I'm saying? Just an overview. One answer to this is found in something that they call covenant theology. Covenant theology. Another answer is found in something called dispensational theology. And a third answer is found in something near and dear to my heart called New Covenant theology. Now, I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just trying to explain. Covenant theology is most classically embodied in the famous document called what? The Westminster Confession of Faith of 1646. Have you all ever heard of that? Now, they didn't invent it, but it's popularized in that. And what denomination, more than any other, is associated with this?
Presbyterian.
The Presbyterian Church. In covenant theology, back to this question, they cannot get the church and Israel apart in any way, shape, form, or fashion. They say Old Testament Israel was the church, and the New Testament church is the true Israel. And so, if I compare that to a train track, here's a train track going along in the Old Testament, that's the church. And then Jesus comes the first time, here's the first coming, and we start the church. Same set of tracks as before, because the church is Israel and Israel is the church. And then we have the second coming, and that's all she wrote. History ends. That's covenant theology. And their thing is continuity, 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 continuity. And they say that because of continuity, 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 that God gave Moses the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, but that's just when it was recorded for us. He gave them to Adam in the Garden of Eden. He just didn't write that down. And by the way, you're still obligated to keep them today too, because guess what? The law of Moses equals the law of Christ. Continuity, continuity. You've got to keep the law of Moses. They're influenced by what you would call Hebrew thinking. If there was no separation of church and state in the Old Testament, we shouldn't have any separation of church and state today. That's why in European history, there never was, for years, any separation of church and state. If you kill heretics in the Old Testament, we ought to kill heretics in the New Testament. And if you circumcise babies in the Old Testament, we're going to change that. We're going to baptize babies today. If you tithe to priests then, we're going to change that a little bit. You're going to tithe to priests now. If there were altars then and priests then, we change that a little bit. We should have altars and priests now. If you had sanctuaries then, we should have a big sanctuary now. See how it goes. Oh, Saturday Sabbath then? Well, we should have one too. We'll just make it Sunday. That's all the outflowing of an approach of covenant theology, this continuity where Old Testament and New Testament are completely equal in importance and authority. In fact, they say the Old Testament is really just a different phase of the new one. They're all really alike. I might come back to that if I have time.
They are church.
It
is Israel.
Yes. Old Testament Israel was the church, and New Testament church is the true Israel. Now, let's talk about dispensational theology. What does it mean to dispense something? Yeah, so if you had a soap dispenser, you get a squirt at a time, you distribute it, okay? So they say God works with different people in different ways throughout history. They mostly chop it up according to the various biblical covenants. But just for good measure, they throw in some other dispensations in between the biblical covenants. They have these various dispensations and say God works with different people at different times in history. That's why it's called dispensationalism. They look at, well, how did God work in the dispensation of law or the dispensation of grace or the dispensation of the millennium? And they have all kind of dispensations. So what they do. That's their thing. Now, whereas covenant theology cannot get the church and Israel apart in any way, dispensational theology is the polar opposite. They cannot get the church and Israel together in any way. And whereas covenant theology is all about continuity, dispensational theology is all about discontinuity. Now, who can tell me who invented dispensational theology? Well, that's not fair. Who really popularized it? Well, there was a Texas lawyer and veteran of the Confederate Army named C.I. Schofield who wrote this Bible called the Schofield Reference Bible. It was real popular in the South. Today, instead of the Schofield Bible, he's been replaced by a different dispensationalism, which is the Ryrie Study Bible. But neither of those two guys really codified all this. Before them, there was a guy who's Plymouth Brethren in England named John Nelson Darby. They're the ones that really wrote about what we now call dispensational theology. Darby's mid-1800s, about 1850, we'll call it.
It's only 150 years old, really.
Yeah, that's right. They say Israel was not the church. And the New Testament church is not Israel. In fact, they say God has two covenant peoples. Israel is His earthly people. The church is His heavenly people. Israel gets earthly blessings, like land and real estate. And the church gets His heavenly spiritual blessing. Remember, the question is it the church and Israel, or the church is Israel? Who's going to say it's church and Israel? What view would say that?
Dispensational.
Dispensational. Who's going to say it's church is Israel?
Covenant.
Let me go back to the railroad track example. If you're a dispensationalist, they would say you've got this set of railroad tracks called Old Testament Israel, and they pull into the station with the first coming of Jesus. But when God's people pull out of the station, all of a sudden we have split identities, and you've got two sets of tracks. You've got Israel parallel with the church. God has two peoples. Then, when the second coming happens, they have a very unique view of end time events that's driven by their view of Israel. And they believe that after Jesus comes back, there is a 1,000-year period of time called the millennium. When the train leaves the station, you're back to one set of tracks again, and it's not the church. It's Israel. And they say God's plan all along and forevermore has been Israel. The church is just a parenthesis in between the first and second coming. So we got Israel, Israel, Israel all the way through. But after Jesus comes back, He comes back to Jerusalem. He rules. He restores Israel to power. All nations pay homage to Israel. They were going to rebuild the temple and start sacrifices again. And classic dispensational theology. But right now, in the church age, they say God has two separate peoples, the church versus Israel. And they're always unflinchingly pro-Israel. And they would tell you that the British Empire fell because they sided with the Arabs instead of the Jews in 1948. And they would always want America to side with Israel, no matter what, because if we go against Israel, God's going to destroy America. That's part of this theology. Yes, sir?
And how the second two times rapture, all of the church is taken up. So that leaves Israel to be saved.
That's correct. I didn't get into it, you're right. The Left Behind series and Late Great Planet Earth is all dispensational theology. They think God raptures the church out of the earth, leaving only Israel to be worked with.
Isn't this one of the most common doctrines nowadays?
Certainly in the South, because Ryrie's a Southerner, Schofield was a Southerner. Because I think of those two study Bibles, a lot of Southern preachers, Stanley would be one of them here in Atlanta, really, really, really teach this. And of course, MacArthur and Chuck Swindoll are pretty well-known radio dispensationalists.
Assemblies like the Assemblies of God, really popular up north. The Church of God, really popular up north. Plymouth Brethren, popular up north. So it's up north, too.
Okay, yeah. Now, then the third view is New Covenant theology. That is most famously codified in the First London Baptist Confession of 1644, 2 years prior to the Westminster. And that reflects New Covenant theology. New Covenant theology is so named because of its emphasis on the New Covenant. Like dispensational theology, it would teach discontinuity. They say it's called new because it's a new deal. It's a totally new thing. But they would say you go from physical Israel to spiritual Israel. So it's kind of a hybrid. New Covenant theology says Old Testament Israel is not the church. So it agrees with dispensationalism there. So here we got Old Testament Israel coming into the station of the New Covenant. Jesus dying on the cross, first time, starts a New Covenant. Leaving the station in the church age, you got a new set of tracks called the church. Up right until the second coming, and bam, that's all she wrote. After that, you're in the new heavens and the earth. New Covenant theology says Old Testament Israel is not the church. It agrees with dispensationalism. But it says the New Testament church is the true Israel. And at that point, they agree with covenant theology. But they say God's finished with physical geopolitical Israel. There's no millennial reign where Israel's supreme.
or it also says that there were people who believed in the true Israelites in the Old Testament were the ones that believed in the same way as Abram, which are the ones that are also in the church.
As having said that, covenant theology and new covenant theology both say that during the new covenant age, God's not finished with ethnic Jews, and many of them will be saved and brought into the church. But it's different from dispensational theology because it has no interest in a geopolitical, national Israel of unbelieving Jews that are still God's people. You see the difference?
You see Jews as unbelievers like anybody
else. Yeah, Jews are just unbelievers like anybody else, and they are saved by election just like anybody else. Right. Al?
Is there a substantive difference between new covenant theology and what is commonly referred to as replacement theology?
Replacement theology is a pejorative term that the dispensational theologians came up with to make both covenant theology and new covenant theology look bad.
Covenant theology and new covenant do not use that term.
They don't say replacement theology. They say it is fulfillment theology. The church is the fulfillment of all the promises made to physical Israel. And since it's the ultimate fulfillment, there's no more to happen. The church is terminal station. There's no more after that. That's what they would say. None of these views is heresy. They're just different. Somebody's wrong. But when you hear somebody, now you kind of maybe have a feel for where they're coming from. And the loudest people on radio and TV right now are the dispensationalists. Yes, sir, Andy.
Now, I always saw new covenant theology as being continuing, having
a spiritual continuity.
A spiritual continuity.
Yes, thank you.
Because Israel is Israel is Israel. The spiritual Israel. Those that believe in the Old Testament, those that believe in the New Testament are God's.
That's right. The reason I didn't say it that way, although you're right. Under New Covenant theology, the emphasis is on the new. There is a disconnect from the old in that the old covenant's made obsolete. What does it say? A new Jerusalem and a new name and a new covenant and a new man. And you look at all the new that's given. There's some disconnect there. The New Testament didn't start till it started. Whereas covenant theology, and I didn't get into this, but we've seen there's many covenants in the Bible. Right? But covenant theology, look at the word covenant, singular or plural? It's like the book of Revelation, singular. When covenant theology talks about the covenant, they ain't talking about nothing in the Bible. They have constructed a theological covenant between the members of the Godhead in eternity past. And when they talk about covenant theology, they're talking about an implicit covenant that they call the covenant of redemption. And out of this covenant of redemption flows two more covenants that are also made up, the covenant of grace and the covenant of works. Goes back to the Garden of Eden. And out of the theological made-up covenant of grace flows two biblical covenants, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, which they say are simply different administrations of the same covenant of grace. So that's that continuity. And that's why there's no disconnect between Old Testament and New Testament in covenant theology. And that's what leads them to view the Old Testament the way they do. It's almost like they interpret the New Testament in light of the Old. New Covenant does it just opposite. It interprets the Old in light of the New. The New Covenant theology says your emphasis should be Jesus, not Jesus and Moses equally. The highest revelation is Jesus, not anything that happened at Sinai. So it's a matter of emphasis. Ed?
Well, Steve, I'm going to put you on the spot, but my feeling is that there's a lot more to be said about this than you have in your notes.
Yeah, there is.
But you can do it another session.
I'll just quit. I might not ever do it another session. But yes, there's a lot more to be said about this.
Maybe next time, do you think that Steve needs to continue along with this one?
Now, the thing is, I don't, it ain't like studying the Bible. We're getting so esoteric here. Good. So Ed'll be teaching in a couple weeks, and he's going to teach on that. Now, Al, you got your hand up.
Just to flip off the wall quick, given the continuity of theology between the New Testament and covenant theology, how would covenant theology respond to the idea of works-based salvation?
It's not possible. They say that's what Adam started out with in the garden, and he failed right off the bat. And God just did that to prove that you can't be saved that way. So none of these three have a false gospel. It's not about that. I don't really care which one you believe. I hope you believe the one I do, which I like New Covenant theology. But it's okay not to believe New Covenant theology. but it's going to take you down different roads of application. So when you look at the European church, it has a sanctuary, like the Old Testament, that has priests, like the Old Testament, that has an altar, like the Old Testament, that pushes tithing, like the Old Testament, that has no separation of church and state, like the Old Testament, that has a Sabbath, like the Old Testament. Now you know why they do. And when you hear the guys on the radio, like Swindoll and MacArthur, and they're Israel, 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 Israel. Now you know why they say that. God's got two peoples, they say. We studied the book Revelation not long ago. And there's four major views of that. You can believe any of the four major views and hold the covenant theology. You can believe any of the four major views and hold the new covenant theology. But if you're a dispensationalist, you are locked into one view. And that's the one that gets all the airways today. The idea of a pre-wrath rapture of the church and a seven-year tribulation period is unique to dispensational theology. And the idea of a premillennial return of Jesus is unique to dispensational theology. It's the only interpretive school that has a forced view of end-time events along with it. And that all goes back to Israel. They got to get Israel back in the land with a temple built, so all the Antichrist stuff can happen. If we ever study prophecy again, then we'll get into the rest of these differences in interpretation and whether you take the Bible literally, literarily, or allegorically. But that's a whole other study. This message was produced by the New Testament Reformation Fellowship, reforming today's church with New Testament church practice. Permission is hereby granted for you to reproduce this message. To learn more about New Testament church life, you can find us on the web at ntrf.org. God bless you as you seek to follow Him in obedience. May your faith in the Lord Jesus be strengthened and your daily walk with Him deepen.